So we began the year just with talking about some things that you might want to do during the course of the year, and did multiple things. Last week we did a big long list. So hopefully you got some things that you can be doing. We're going to begin a new series today. I would like for us to do a rather slow and a rather thorough study of the book of Galatians. And during the study of the book, we'll do a couple of tangents on some of the content that we find there. And just on a side note here right at the beginning, one thing that I hope happens during the course of the series, it's Galatians is actually a major player in the book that I've been working on. It's a book about walking in the Spirit. Galatians, of course, is a book where we find listed the fruit of the Spirit. In Galatians, we find the exhortation, if you live by the Spirit, let us also walk by the Spirit. And so during the course of the series, I hope to have a preliminary draft of the book ready. And I want to offer it to any of you who would like to read it, read the preliminary draft. The only requirement will be that if you read it, you have to give me some feedback. Like, you know, use this to start fires in your fireplace, or don't bother, or too fast, too slow, some type of feedback. But there will be actually some connection to some things in the book, to some of the things that we encounter in the book of Galatians. So I hope to make that available fairly soon. And if you would be interested in reading it just in draft form, you would be most welcome, and I would welcome the feedback from you. Galatians has a pretty strong case, perhaps being the first book chronologically in the New Testament. Putting together a chronology of the New Testament church is a challenging thing. You got to do a lot of sleuthing to do that. And then placing within that chronology of the church the writing of the New Testament books is also very challenging. One of the tangents that we'll do as we go through Galatians is just a chronology of the life of Paul, because the chronology of his life is very interesting and probably different, unless you've studied it, than you might guess. But it's a challenging thing to do a chronology of the whole first century, the New Testament church and the writing of all the New Testament canon. So it might be helpful just to have in your head a very simple chronology of the first century. Jesus' crucifixion and resurrection is around 30 AD, so 30 years in, Jesus is crucified and resurrection. Pentecost happens 50 days later, 10 days after the ascension. So that also happens around 30 AD. The Damascus Road, when Paul gets converted, is probably around 33, so like 3 years later, that the Damascus Road happens, 33, 34. Paul's missionary journeys, there's three of them, they do not happen till the late 40s and through the 50s. So there's a pretty big gap from when Paul gets converted around 33, 34, in the missionary journeys that probably don't start till way at the end of the 40s. And they don't actually last very long, not much more than a decade. And then he's in prison until he's probably off the scene. But those missionary journeys happen at the end of the 40s and the early part, middle 50s. Paul is probably martyred in Rome around 64 AD. Under Nero. The book of Acts probably goes to about 62 AD, and then Luke stops the story because he's got the gospel to Rome. And so then it's just what we have by tradition. Paul is probably martyred in Rome around 64 AD. The earliest books of the New Testament are written in probably the late 40s, early 50s. So it's at least 20 years from Jesus' death and resurrection before any New Testament books are written. Some of the earliest books of the New Testament are probably 1st and 2nd Thessalonians, Paul's letter to the Thessalonians. James might also be early, but it's really hard to date James. Galatians is also early. There's a good chance that Galatians is the earliest, around 48-49 AD. Then the writing of the New Testament books, all 27 in the canon, takes probably 40 or more years. So starting there right before 50, the final books of the New Testament are probably not written until the late 80s into the 90s. John being the one who probably writing right at the end. So a good number of the New Testament books are written after Paul's death. Don't picture Paul running around with a New Testament like we had. A good deal of the New Testament books, probably Hebrews, all the writings of John, and the Gospels, perhaps all of them. Gospels are written later than a lot of the letters of the New Testament. So keep that chronology in the back of your mind, and we'll do more specifically something about Paul's own story from that Damascus road. What's he doing from 33, 34, up to when he finally goes on missionary journeys at the end of the 40s? What's he doing all those years? But Galatians makes a strong case, perhaps, for being like the first book chronologically of the whole New Testament. One reason that I want to do a study that's rather slow and thorough of the book is that Galatians is often seen as one of the books that teaches justification by faith. And it certainly does do that. It's rightfully seen as a book that teaches justification by faith. But often the issue of justification by faith is taken as synonymous with getting saved. That those are basically the same thing. And getting saved means accepting Christ and becoming a Christian. That's how a person gets saved. He accepts Christ into his heart, becomes a Christian. So Galatians must be about how one becomes a Christian and gets saved by faith. And then we read Galatians expecting that, like, okay, Galatians gets to tell us, because it talks about justification by faith, about how to become a Christian and get saved by faith. So we read Galatians expecting to hear that and find what we're expecting. I think probably that sequence of thought is very sloppy, actually, and way too fast. It misses a great deal and probably has considerable distortion in it. Galatians does not actually use the word save or salvation. It's not found, not once, in Galatians. In that sense, Galatians is not about salvation. Being justified and being saved may not be mere synonyms with each other. And being justified may not simply be language for becoming a Christian. In fact, I'm going to try to persuade you that Galatians is not primarily about becoming a Christian, how a person becomes a Christian. Galatians is written to those who have already become Christians. Well, they did that. Galatians is written to those who have been born again of the Spirit of God. So Galatians is primarily not about new birth and how a person gets saved. Rather, Galatians is primarily about life to be lived after new birth. So Galatians isn't about how you get on the team, how you get on the Christian team. That's not what Galatians is about. Galatians about is the game that the team is supposed to play after the team is put together. That's what Galatians is about. So it's not about how to be born again. And to just get that from the book, I think, misses a lot and distorts a great deal of what's there. Galatians is about how do you run the race after being born again. So today, all I hope to do is to get us started, and I hope to stir your interest. I don't know if I'll be successful. In some ways, I really like introductions because I hope it can build some anticipation and makes you hungry for what God's Word says. In other ways, I dread introductions because you'll say, "Connie, you didn't say anything today." But take a look at the handout that I gave you. There are 6 chapters in the book of Galatians. Probably the simplest way to understand why did Paul's letters get arranged in the New Testament the way they did is they're just arranged from the longest to the shortest. So Romans is first because that's the longest letter we have, then 1st and 2nd Corinthians, and then Galatians. And then as they get shorter until you get down to like Philemon, way at the end. So Galatians is after Romans and 1st and 2nd Corinthians. It has 6 chapters, but that's still not very many. I think it's 195 verses. On the handout is a sampling of phrases found in those 6 chapters. And I'm hoping that these phrases just make you wonder, what is happening in the churches of Galatia that Paul writes these kinds of words? Galatians might not only be the earliest letter, Galatians might be the crabbiest letter in the New Testament. The tone of Galatians is quite harsh in places, actually very harsh in some places. But something is going on in Galatians that generates very interesting language from the Apostle Paul. Hopefully I captured a little bit here on the handout. There's a lot more, actually, even though there's 6 chapters, than what's here on the handout. But I'm hoping to make you wonder a little bit of what could be going on there that makes Paul say the kinds of things that he says. And again, I'm hoping just to whet your appetite. If you can go down this whole list and say, "Oh, I know what that means, and the reason Paul said it is because such and such, please come see me. I'd like you to teach some of these sessions." Everyone, I know what that means, and I know why it's there in the letter. You know you're getting probably pretty warm as far as understanding Galatians. But Paul says, "I am amazed that you are so quickly deserting him who called you by the grace of Christ." I mean, what does one do to desert Christ? What do you think they're doing? That they're deserting him. Paul's amazed by the fact that they're deserting him. So what are they doing? "There are some who are disturbing you and want to distort the gospel of Christ." How can the gospel get distorted? You know, does that remind you of somebody? That reminds me of Carlin. She's always distorting the gospel. How do you distort the gospel? "If any man is preaching to you a gospel contrary to what you received," it's in Galatians that we get if somebody preaches a different gospel, "and here a gospel contrary to what you received, he is to be accursed." He is to be anathema. Strong curse word in the Greek. So are there things that claim to be the gospel and are not gospel? It's a contrary gospel. What might that be? "False brethren secretly brought in who had sneaked in to spy out our liberty, which we have in Christ Jesus, in order to bring us into bondage." Kind of a conspiratorial, isn't it? You ever have anybody sneak in to spy out your liberty? It's one of the things I'm hoping happens before I die. Somebody sneaks in to spy out the liberty that we have. But then in order to bring us into bondage. Bondage to what? What's this spying out the liberty to bring us into bondage? What makes them say that? "I saw that they were not straightforward about the truth of the gospel. I might encourage you of the things on the list." Memorize this phrase. What's involved in being straightforward about the gospel? What might you do to not be straightforward about it? Paul says there were some who weren't being straightforward about the truth of the gospel. What were they doing? "Through the law, I died to the law." What does that mean? And why talk about the law? Well, why does that come up? "If righteousness comes through the law, then Christ died needlessly." So what kind of claim is being made here? I thought the law was good. But how can you make Christ's death unnecessary? I mean, that sounds pretty serious. How can one do that to make it kind of, well, if that's so, Christ didn't need to die. So what's that about? You foolish Galatians, who has bewitched you? I'm going to say a little bit more about this in a moment. But note again, just the feel of amazement, of bewilderment, of astonishment on Paul's side. Surprise that you're so quickly deserting. And you foolish Galatians, who's bewitching you? It says the law of not of faith. What does that mean? People who believe don't think the law is right? What do you mean the law is not of faith? But the law was revelation of the will of God. You turn back again to the weak and worthless elemental things to which you desire to be enslaved all over again. So what are the weak and worthless things? Might Jeff be turning back to the weak and worthless things, the elemental things? You're going to be enslaved all over again. Again, a note of bondage. Bondage to what? And what are the things, you know, these weak and worthless things that you're being turned to? Perhaps I have labored over you in vain. Paul really worried that it could all be for nothing? And what would that mean if it is in vain? Does that mean they're not Christians? And they're going to hell? What's going on here that he's fearful that he's maybe labored in vain? I could wish to be present with you and to change my tone, for I am perplexed about you. Again, just that note of perplexity, of amazement, of astonishment. We'll come back to that in a second. He says, if you receive circumcision, Christ will be of no benefit to you. I mean, wasn't circumcision a good thing? If you commit adultery, Christ will be of no benefit to you. That might make sense to that, but if you receive circumcision, Christ is of no benefit? What's going on there? And what does Paul mean by saying that? You have been severed from Christ. Very strong language, isn't it? You have fallen from grace. I didn't know you could fall from grace. Certainly sounds like something you don't want to do. How can you fall from grace? You were running well. Who hindered you? This has the same feel as deserting him. You were there. I mean, you were running well. Things were going smoothly. You were on track, but then you went off the rails. What happened? It has that type of feel to it. And then the stumbling block of the cross has been abolished. And what does the cross have to do with whatever it is going on? And how do you abolish whatever the stumbling block of it is? So there's just a sampling of the first. I hope they make you wonder, what is going on there? I mean, it sounds really serious, doesn't it? But what are they actually doing? Are they selling drugs in the church bookstore? Is that what generates all the talk? Are they pursuing rampant materialism? They're just getting way in over their head on their credit cards? Just buying stuff and junk? Is that what generates the talk? Are they hosting drinking parties? When everybody's getting drunk, partying? Is that what generates you're deserting him who called you? All these wild parties? Are they engaging in sexual misconduct? And what is it that they're actually doing that generates the kind of talk that you get in the letter? Sounds serious, but what is it? Hopefully that stirs your interest in to explore the book some. How in 6 chapters does he say all these kinds of things? What is he talking about? What is he worried about? I encourage you, of course, to go read the book. And you'll find the phrases, how do they weave together into the narrative of the letter. So I really only want to try to get you interested today. If you really want something positive to get you interested, I think Galatians can help us learn to walk by the Spirit. That's a positive thing. If that interests you, I think you should be interested in Galatians. I don't know if I've ever met anybody who says, you know, I'm really good at walking by the Spirit. I know lots of people who would like to do that. I've done it in rooms where I've said, how many of you, if you were supposed to walk by the flesh, could be really good at it? All the hands go up. I could figure out what my flesh wanted, and if I was okay to follow my flesh, I could be really good at that. But, of course, we don't want to walk by the flesh. And I said, how many of you want to walk by the Spirit and all the hands go up? How many of you are really good at walking by the Spirit and all the hands go down? Galatians, I think, can help us know what it means to walk by the Spirit, to walk as new creation. So if that's attracted to you, you should be attracted to Galatians. But I actually hope that some of the negative things of the book also get you interested. And I want to call it just attention to just one negative thing. Not to accuse us, I just wanted to, it's a very interesting thing that this can happen in the Christian life. And how does it work in the Christian life? I think in these quotes, you can sense a certain feeling of present, this feeling of surprise. I'm amazed that you're so quickly deserting. There's this feeling of amazement, of puzzlement, of bewilderment, of astonishment. Paul's amazed that they're so quickly deserting. You know, he wants to know who has bewitched them. He's perplexed about them. He wishes he could change his tone. The letter has this feeling of it was going well. What happened? How did it all come off the rails? What happened? I'm amazed. I think that feeling of astonishment, of surprise, alerts us, alerts me at least, to a danger that I think we all face in running the race. I think it alerts us to one of the ways that sin can hinder us in running the race. And I actually think the danger is quite acute for us because it goes against a conceit that we all are encouraged in our time to have. And the conceit is that I know what is best for me. All of us are encouraged that you know what's best for you. I have to do what's right for me. So even if you disagree, I can claim to know what's right for me. Who would know better what's right for me than me? Well, I have to do what's best for me. We're encouraged to hold that perspective. That I'm calling the conceit. It's not a claim that I never make a bad decision. That's not the claim. Rather, the claim, the conceit, is that no one knows better, what's better for Roger than Roger. That's the conceit. Nobody knows what's better for me than me. And nobody knows what's better for you than you. So if you claim that you're doing the right thing for yourself, what's best for you, nobody can challenge it. Because who knows better what's right for you than you? But one thing that sin can do to each of us, and it has done so since the beginning, is beguile us. That's one of the things that sin can do when it's present, is beguile us. And it beguiles us into making absolutely horrible decisions and choices. Amazingly poor decisions. Perplexingly lousy choices. Astonishingly stupid direction. Sin has the ability to beguile us. You just do something astonishingly stupid. Look at the two passages at the bottom of the handout. The first is from Jeremiah 2. The Lord himself is speaking. And the Lord calls attention to something that's astonishing, something that's appalling. He says, has a nation changed gods when they were not gods? Implied answer, no. But my people have changed their glory for that which does not profit. Be appalled, O heavens, at this, and shudder. Be very desolate, declares the Lord. For my people have committed two evils. They have forsaken me, the fountain of living waters, to hew for themselves cisterns, broken cisterns that can hold no water. And you might expect nations that worship false gods, worship idols, to routinely change those gods. You might expect that, actually. After all, the gods are worthless. It's a block of wood overlaid with gold. It can't do anything. So you might expect, if you had one of those gods, you would routinely be bringing it back to the store and wanting a refund or get a different one. This one's not doing anything, right? If you had a god who wasn't a god, you'd soon figure that out and found a different one. But amazingly enough, those with false gods tend to keep them. But then you would not expect the nation that actually had the fountain of living water. You would not expect that nation to desert that, to get rid of that, to rebel against that. They have the fountain of living water. You would not expect them to forsake that. And then instead, to make a cistern that holds no water. Like, how stupid is that? I mean, it's astonishingly stupid. But sin can beguile us to do that. I just want you to hear that. Look at the next passage out of Hebrews 12. See to it that no one comes short of the grace of God. That sounds a little bit like you have fallen from grace, right? That no root of bitterness springing up causes trouble, and that by it many be defiled. That there be no immoral or godless person like Esau, who sold his own birthright for a single meal. This text reminds us that the immorality and the godlessness of Esau was demonstrated by the fact that he sold his own birthright for a single meal. I mean, just an astonishingly poor choice. And even if he could have got a whole year of meals out of it, at least, right? Or 3 years of meals, still would have been a bad deal. But he sold his birthright for a single meal. And soup. It's like, what was he thinking? I'm amazed that he would have done that. I hope you've made some decision in your life where you've looked back at it and you go, what in heaven's name was I thinking when I did that? I don't know where I was, but like, you know, my elevator didn't go to the top, or whatever your cute phrase is. A couple French fries short of a full order, whatever. I don't know what I was thinking when I made that, because like, I can't see any good reason for having made it. Why did I sell my birthright for a single bowl of red soup? It's worth, I think, sitting and pondering just the stunningly poor decisions that can be made by people, that can be made by me, can be made by you. And of course, it begins in the Garden of Eden. They literally had paradise. Why would you wreck it? And you only have one rule, just one. You can eat from any tree of the garden. But this beautiful place, you can run around naked, you're not ashamed. They're in paradise. Why would you wreck it? There's one tree that you can't eat out of. Serpent beguiled me. Consider this, the reality of a people standing there having the person up on the platform saying, I set before you death. Choose life. The consequences of each choice spelled out in great detail. Take chapters. Here, if you choose death, what will happen? And here, what will happen if you choose life? You'll get prosperity. You'll get abundance. You'll get peace. You'll see your grandkids to the fourth generation type of thing. Or you can have famine, defeat at the top of your enemies, kids raped, exile. You want door number one or door number two? And they chose death. It's a stunningly poor decision, isn't it? Be careful about thinking, I would not have done that. If I had been in the Garden of Eden, I wouldn't have done it. If I had been there and had death and life set before me, God had chose life. I'm a lot smarter than them. Put yourself there on a Friday morning. Among a people versed in Scripture, among a people zealous for obedience to God. And you get asked, do you want Jesus or Barabbas? Do you want the Lord of glory, the incarnate Word of God, or do you want a notorious thief? It chose Barabbas. Galatians is the glorious freedom of the children of God on one side versus weak and worthless elements that enslave you on the other side. And Paul is perplexed. He's amazed. He's astonished that they're making the choice to go back to the weak and worthless elements and be enslaved again rather than embrace the glorious liberty of the children of God. You're deserting him who calls you. It's an astonishing thing. It's a sobering thing, isn't it? That sin can cause us to make those types of decisions. Those things stir in me a very earnest prayer that in running the race, that I don't end up saying, well, you know, I have to do what's best for me. And in saying that, I just make an incredibly crummy decision. Astonishingly poor. I think I'll get rid of the fountain and make a broken cistern. That's your decision, Roger? You're going to get rid of the fountain of living water and make a broken cistern that can't hold water? I got to do what's right for me, you know. I'm going to desert Christ, get severed from him, fall from the grace, and go back to the weak and worthless elements so I can be enslaved and in bondage again. That's your decision? Be careful for the sake, I would never do that. I hope Galatians every now and then pins us. Oh, seems amazingly stupid to do it, amazingly foolish, but I can see why it can be done. I've been tempted to do that, or maybe I've done that. The letter speaks about being straightforward about the gospel. Here's my prayer, that by the time we're finished with it, you adopt a couple of conclusions. That you say, you know what, it is not easy to be straightforward about the gospel. That you adopt that conclusion. It's not easy to be straightforward about the gospel. And your second conclusion, it might not be easy, but I'm going to be straightforward about the gospel. That's my prayer, that by the end of the letter, don't too quickly say, oh yeah, I would never cheat on the gospel, I would never distort it, I would never make it different, never turn from it, never invalidate it, never cut myself off from it. It's not so easy to be straightforward about the gospel. But then to say, by the power of God, by his Spirit, I'm going to be straightforward about it. That's my prayer. Hopefully stirs your interest. If those negative things of how do they make such a poor decision scares you or something, then go with a positive thing. It can teach you to walk by the Spirit. I want to learn how to do that. I hope it stirs your interest. And we'll work kind of slow and carefully at it. May the Lord be with us. Mm.